Case number 11-5268, George Leon Adams, appellant versus Scott A. Middlebrooks. Mr. Axum for the appellant, Mr. Apperson for the appellee.
Good morning, Mr. Axum.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to reserve, Tony Axum representing the appellant, George Adams, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The appellant, George Adams, requests remand for the district court to decide in the first instance whether his actual innocence claim serves as an exception to the statute of limitations under 2254.
Can I ask you where before the response to the order to show cause you raised actual innocence?
I did not raise actual innocence before the response to the order to show cause.
Don't we have a timeliness problem there as well?
I'm not sure that I have a timeliness problem, or I'm unaware of one. As the court is aware, the court granted...
Well, I mean, you've known about the actual innocence argument or defense before the order to show cause.
As a defense to the statute of limitations, and it is correct that I miscalculated the time period within which Mr. Adams could proceed under 2244. I'm just unaware of why the court should not consider, certainly where actual innocence here is strong, that is an exception to 2244. As the court is aware, it granted a COA on very limited grounds. The actual innocence claim was raised as a standalone claim, and the district court dismissed that. And it is my error for not focusing on something that was dismissed that was not part of the original COA. I tried to focus on what the court asked me to address, and timing was never an issue until the government raised it, and intervening decision of Head v. Wilson. I'd also note that McQuiggan's was an intervening decision after the district court ruled in this case without addressing specifically whether actual innocence was an exception to the statute of limitations. So it's not something that the district court ever reached.
Right. But if we hadn't issued the order to show cause, you would not have been arguing what you're arguing on actual innocence, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
There's always the possibility that I would have asked for supplemental briefing, or asked the court to delay oral argument if it's something that I had noticed, and it's not something that I ignored. Or I ignored it only insofar as it went to the standalone actual innocence claim. And again, that's an error on my part, but it's squarely before the court now, and the district court did not properly consider the exception. I think that the court should remand, just as in McQuiggan's, for the district court to decide it in the first instance.
Can you take us through your view of the actual innocence claim, regardless of whether it's a gateway claim or a flat-out remedial claim?
Well, Mr. Adams, in his 2254 petition, submitted three affidavits from witnesses, a fourth affidavit from himself, as well as his original statement to the police. And I'd say first, the original statement to the police is compelling because the day he's arrested in 1995, he tells the police, "I was in another part of town and I was with all of these people," before he's even aware of like the full scope of why he's arrested. And some of those people, he gives a list of over 15 people. So this is not an 11th hour claim by Mr. Adams that he had alibi. It's correct. Proceeding pro se through much of his post-conviction proceedings and certainly in federal court, he did not always have the language of alibi, but he referred to exculpatory witnesses, witnesses who were in court very early in his pleadings, witnesses who were in court who his attorney refused to call. And we learn later through the affidavit, one of the affidavits he submitted of Ms. Wilson, that she was in court and the attorney did not call her. Each of the three affidavits, Wilson, Owens, and Clark, placed Mr. Adams at a location, at the location that he said he was at in his original statement to the police the day he was arrested, that is on the other side of town. It's in Northeast. It's in Southeast. The crime took place in Northeast. And
although the district court somewhat overstated the problem, there is some vagueness in the affidavits about the timing of events.
I strongly
they never say, even the strongest one, which goes from 8 to 10:30, doesn't say that Adams was continuously with them in that time zone.
It's correct. They don't emphasize that he was continuously with them, but the statement that that I was at this location from 8 to 10 with Mr. Adams suggests just that, that they are at that location during those hours with him. If there's a question about that, that's precisely the type of question that, the district court should decide. The district court, I believe the language the district court used was that none of the affidavits stated that affiant stated that they were with Mr. Adams for an extended period of time. It really doesn't matter whether it's an extended period of time. The crime took place between 9 and 9:43. We know that the police arrived and began investigating. So that the witnesses say
that. The point in part the district court was focusing on was it was 20 minutes apart.
I'm sorry?
The two sites were 20 minutes apart. I mean, in other words, you're arguing, as I take it now, that there was clear error by the district court in its findings of fact in looking at the affidavits, some of which he said was not new evidence, but there was one affidavit she acknowledged was new.
Yes. The district court doesn't say anything about Mr. Adams' affidavit, and he says he was at that location from 8 to 12. I understand that there's always
8 to 10, I thought.
I believe that
the police got the call at 9:43 or 44 about the murder.
Or the police were at the scene investigating at 9:43. So they had by that time arrived at the scene of the crime. So the witnesses testified that they went into the woods at approximately 9 o'clock.
So what I'm trying to understand is you're presenting this as an impossibility scenario, correct? That if he's in one place at one time, he can't be in another place at another time.
That is correct.
And his defense attorney spoke to some of these alibi witnesses. Either one came to him and he talked to another and another was in court. The case was appealed to the D.C. Court of Appeals. This ineffective assistance of counsel issue raised, correct?
Ineffective assistance of counsel was raised, but not this precise issue that counsel...
Well, I thought it was failure to call these alibi witnesses. That wasn't raised?
At some point that was raised by Mr. Adams pro se in the district.
Before the D.C. Court of Appeals?
Yes.
So it was raised?
Yes.
All right, and that court affirmed. In other words, I see this case as you're presenting it to us, is McQuiggan comes, and even though the district court looked at this case from McCleskey versus Zant, we ought to look at it in terms of McQuiggan and decide that this is an impossibility situation and everybody else missed this, and we ought to send it back to the district court. And you may be right, but you understand it's a very difficult road to...
I do understand that. I think it's
and
a
so
fair...
And so McQuiggan says you really have a very heavy burden because the court goes at length to say that this is going to be a rare situation.
I agree. It is a rare situation, and I think you have a rare situation here.
No, but in other words, if you and I were together and you had sworn out an affidavit saying we were together from 8 to 10, and there was some way to verify that as opposed to we're just wandering around the street and we're in the same area, generally speaking, but you and I weren't arm to arm for 2 hours. Do you have to plug up holes like that to meet the burden under McQuiggan?
I would say that you should plug up holes like that to meet the burden under McQuiggan, but I'd like the court to remember that each affidavit was prepared by a witness. There's no indication that there was aid of counsel.
But you're stuck with the case you have. I mean, are you going to call these witnesses now and have them testify on remand?
I don't think that McQuiggan's would foreclose that. I don't think McQuiggan's would foreclose
Do we need to be clear that you have access to these witnesses? I mean, do you have to make some proffer?
I don't think McQuiggan's requires me to make a proffer.
Okay.
I believe that...
How do we determine that this is one of those rare cases that a district court might find, even though previously it had not found?
Well, I think the district court has to decide. I don't think the court has to decide that the district court might find, even though it previously has not. The district court did not decide it under McQuiggan's at all.
But it did under McCleskey versus Zant, all right, and was looking at the claim. That's all I'm getting at. And don't you have...
The finding of fact that the district court made was that the witnesses were not with Mr. Adams for an extended period of time. I understand that that possibility could exist, but there is no evidence in this record that they were not with him. In fact, I suggest to the court that the exact opposite inference, when these witnesses are preparing affidavits and saying, I was with him, I know that in colloquial terms, a layperson may not realize that they need to be very specific and hammer down times.
So you're saying the district court's finding was clearly erroneous?
Well, there's absolutely no support for the fact or for the inference, for the suggestion, for the possibility that Mr. Adams was not with these people. I'm submitting to the court that the exact opposite inference is suggested by the witness's affidavit.
But you have to show that. I'm just trying to understand what our standard of review here is. The district court made some findings of fact.
Yes. Well, the standard of review is that the new evidence shows it more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted.
What new evidence?
The new evidence are the affidavits.
But the district court found that, what was it, three of them weren't new and one that was new.
Well, the district court did not reference Mr. Adams' affidavit at all. There were four affidavits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd submit to the court that that's a problem. The district court also did not evaluate any of these affidavits in light of the other evidence in the case. And as I laid out in my opening brief, the other evidence in this case is not strong. It is strictly identification evidence. There is no, and identification evidence is inconsistent. Of the two witnesses that are right there at the scene of the murder, one of them does not pick Mr. Adams out of the photo array. One of them picks Mr. Adams out, but both of them at trial say that Mr. Adams looks different. And they say that he looks different in the exact same ways, different than the person who committed the murder. So there's no indication in this record that the district court weighed, even if these affidavits are weak, even if they are not as strong as this court would like to see, even if they don't hammer down, looked at all of the evidence in the case, which is what McQuiggan's requires, when you combine these affidavits, I strongly encourage the court to include the affidavit of Mr. Adams. I know the court is saying that there's a possibility that Mr. Adams left and came back, but his affidavit says, I was at the blacktop from 8 to 12. So he doesn't need someone else to actually confirm that he did not leave. He's saying that was the location he was at. The district court would have to draw from nowhere evidence that he left and came back. And that's an improper inference to draw.
Counsel, can I? I'd like to ask you about the original briefing on the question of inadequacy of appellate counsel. Now, the district court found a passage which enumerates three theories and addresses them. And as far as I can make out, you don't question the court's treatment of those three.
Three theories.
Well, the passage at page 51, 52 of the joint appendix appears to be the source of the inadequacy of appellate counsel arguments that she addressed. She did not address the assertion, which is tucked away at page 32 of the joint appendix, or 34 perhaps, 34 of the joint appendix, which is really what we're talking about here. So I'm wondering whether there is not a procedural fault in Adams' papers in raising the insufficiency of appellate counsel claim that you are now relying on. If you look at 51-52, you'll see the enumeration of three theories, and then if you look at 34, you'll see the sort of straight out alibi claim, but which the district court never saw as an insufficiency of appellate counsel argument. I honestly think reasonably. So why wasn't that just a procedural issue, which at least in this proceeding, not speaking about future litigation in the D.C. courts or whatever, is preclusive? Or put another way, requires affirmance.
Your Honor, I apologize. I have totally lost you. If the court is referring to page 34 of the, I don't see three arguments on page
34. No, that's the place where the alibi, the idea of an alibi defense is best put, although none too good. And then there's this sort of enumeration starting on, which actually, I mean, now that I look at them, even the one at 34 is somewhat defective. But it doesn't seem to me, I put it this way, I think the district court gave the insufficiency of appellate advocacy a very good, I mean, under the circumstances, a thorough treatment.
Well, the district court said that Mr. Adams didn't raise it at all.
Well, the district court does address the those three claims, right? I don't have the, just a second.
The three claims on page 51?
Yeah, 51, 52, goes over to 52. It's
her treatment at page 169, about there. No, that's, I'm sorry, 169 is the actual innocence. Then it's 171 that she takes on the three theories of inadequacy of appellate counsel.
And is it 163 that has the five?
Okay.
No, it's 5152 that has the three enumerated arguments, and then they are addressed by the district court at 171, 172.
Yes, I see those.
So but in terms of what the district court addressed for inadequacy of appellate counsel, and what the papers before her identified as the alleged inadequacy of appellate counsel, why wasn't that perfectly correct?
Well, it appears that the district court addressed three issues but left the alibi.
Yeah, but that's the way the petitioner framed it.
Well, again, petitioner has proceeded pro se.
I understand.
Liberally construing his pleading, the question is whether he raised it at all. He certainly raised it. That the district court did not see it or didn't give it.
You say he raised it, but you're putting a very substantial burden on the district court to figure out what might lie behind a claim. I understand we're dealing with a prisoner acting pro se.
Where the petitioner has raised it, the court does have a duty to review it. The court does have a duty to decide it.
It's your premise that I'm questioning. The premise that the petitioner did raise it adequately.
In the original 2254, or in his pleadings in federal court.
Pleadings in federal court, right.
I guess if the pleading is insufficient, I don't know what to say, but I'd submit to the court that the pleading here is not insufficient. Appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to acknowledge petitioner's right to an alibi defense.
I just don't know what that even means. And I think it's putting a heavy burden on the district court to figure out what that means.
Well, all of his exhibits go to the alibi defense. The affidavits go to the alibi defense. That the district court didn't discern that is, I guess that's why I'm at a loss, that the district court overlooked that because of insufficient pleading from a pro se client when it is really the only legitimate claim that he has. The other claims the district court is able to dismiss fairly quickly. It's the alibi defense that has evidence to support it. That the district court certainly should have realized that's what he was saying.
Yes, counsel, is there any way in which the appellate insufficiency argument is stronger than the trial counsel insufficiency argument?
Insofar as the appellate counsel had the entire record before him, yes.
More of a record than the trial counsel?
Well, he had the record of the trial. He had the discovery. He had a bird's eye view of what had already happened. Of the arguments he raised, none was likely to result in reversal. Since he was in a superior position, knowing everything that the trial attorney already knew, he had a greater duty to to identify a trial counsel's ineffectiveness. In absolute terms, are they both ineffective? Yes, they're both ineffective. But
we've taken you way beyond your time.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Has he answered your question?
What?
Has he answered your question?
I think so. Okay. I mean, I think it's much of an answer.
You're over your time, Mr. Axton. We'll give you a minute in reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Apperson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jay Apperson for the United States. Your Honor, the ineffective actual innocence claim is not included in the COA in the first instance. It is assuredly waived, having been raised only for the first time in response to this Court's order to show cause. It lacks merit in any event. Judge Huvel applied the correct legal standard, even though McQuiggan was not decided. The district court clearly stated that not only was it untimely, but said that it did not meet the legal standard as set forth in McQuiggan, previously held in the earlier cases. An appellant cannot show that it is more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted in light of this evidence, particularly in light of the strength of the government's case. Contrary to appellant's counsel's suggestion, this most significant witness, Sterling Johnson, knew appellant and had known him for years from the 80s and 90s, knew his nickname, knew his actual name, and saw him come out of the woods. He was then the victim of a robbery by the same individual getting the same car 2 days later. The DCCA noted the strength of the government's evidence with respect to identification. In addition to Sterling Johnson, the other witnesses who had been held up were in the woods during the time when the victim was held up and robbed of heroin, identified him in court, appellant in court. They had previously identified him in photo arrays. Other dispassionate witnesses who were on the scene had also identified appellant, one in court and another in a photo array. So the government's evidence with respect to this man being at the murder scene was very strong, as the DCCA noted, in affirming the conviction and the denial of the initial ineffective assistance of trial counsel. The court applied the correct legal standard and found that the appellant's evidence was neither timely nor credible nor reliable. And that's exactly what McQuiggan stands for, that the court can consider the issue of the timeliness. And let's be candid here. The underlying claim is that his trial counsel didn't present alibi witnesses. Well, appellant knew that at trial. Clearly, counsel did not call alibi witnesses. And the question of whether or not there's a stronger claim of appellant counsel being ineffective than the trial counsel, with respect, that's absurd. The trial counsel interviewed the supposed alibi witnesses. The trial counsel subpoenaed that witnesses for trial and made a tactical decision not to call that witness, those witnesses, because those witnesses were identified by appellant in his initial statement as drug dealers, heroin dealers. Bringing a heroin dealer to give an alibi witness testimony at trial would have only confirmed that appellant is a heroin dealer, and that was the very nature of the robbery and the murder. He went into the woods to rob somebody of heroin because he's a heroin dealer. And now he wants to suggest that it's ineffective to present heroin dealers as witnesses in light of the government's evidence that he was at the murder scene. Extraordinary evidence, strong evidence of the identification. Appellant simply cannot meet the burden. Appellant's own affidavit, you compare his statement to the police, and his later affidavit, his statement to the police said, I was on the blacktop from 7 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock that night. His later affidavit contradicts that and says, oh, no, I was walking from a residence as late as 8:20 and before I got to the blacktop, and I left at noon. So his own statements that he offers as actual innocence are contradictory. The district court was correct in characterizing the other affidavits. And remember, the affidavits themselves were untimely. One was executed in 2003, another in 2004. But the information was certainly known to appellant. It was in his original statement. And he knew at trial that his counsel did not present these witnesses. And the record supports the trial counsel made a tactical decision in not presenting those witnesses for the reasons that I've discussed. So appellant simply, even if this court were to entertain this claim at this stage, and I would urge the court not to do that, appellant cannot meet the standard under McQuiggan, and that's the standard that the district court properly applied. His information is neither timely nor credible nor reliable, and this court should not be asked to second-guess that determination.
McQuiggan reduces the timeliness issue to sort of a factor in applying the actual innocence theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's it's the other two that are really critical. Timeliness just being
absolutely, and that's the treatment that the district court noted, that it was untimely, and recognized the third affidavit itself was furnished more recently in 2011. Though again, the information was certainly known to appellant at the time of his arrest, much less the time of the trial. So that the district court properly applied that. It did not say these affidavits are untimely, and therefore I will not consider your claim. To the contrary, it said it analyzed exactly as McQuiggan taught and said that that is one factor, and that's how the district court treated it as one factor, because it made a finding that not only are they untimely, but appellant has not met the burden, and the court set out the burden, the legal standard, correctly as McQuiggan, because it was the same standard in the earlier cases on that issue. So the district court properly applied the correct legal standard here. Appellant cannot show clear error on the factual findings by the court.
Could I just be clear as to the government's position? Is the government's position that this court lacks jurisdiction in terms of this was not in the certificate of appealability and there was no appeal of that? Or is the government saying, yes, that was its position, but in light of McQuiggan, we should address McQuiggan, the McQuiggan argument?
No, you should not address the McQuiggan. I think the court does lack jurisdiction. Not only is it not part of the COA in the first instance, it is waived, and, of course, his underlying claim is time-barred in any event.
So let me just be clear. You said a lot very quickly. Let me understand precisely what the government's position is.
I think the court does lack jurisdiction because it is the question of actual innocence is not in the COA.
And McQuiggan,
the later claim is waived because it's raised for the first time in response to this court's order to show cause.
And McQuiggan doesn't affect any of that?
I don't think it does affect that. I'm making an alternative argument, even if this court.
No, I understand, but yes. I'm just, because you haven't had a chance to brief this.
To brief it.
So I'm trying to understand what the government's position is, because I understood your first position as it's laid out in your brief, but now this case has evolved.
Well, I think McQuiggan goes to how you analyze an actual innocence claim if it were before the court. For the reasons I've stated, I don't think it is before the court. But even if this court were to entertain it, McQuiggan, the district court followed the standard of McQuiggan, did not use the untimely affidavits as an absolute bar. To the contrary, considered it, as McQuiggan taught, that is one factor, and that goes to a determination of credibility and reliability. And the entire record, the entire record shows not only untimeliness and huge untimeliness. I mean, these affidavits were way late. The claims were way late, never raised the ineffective assistance of trial counsel for not preventing an alibi until 2004, after shifting positions. Never raised the appellate counsel argument 2008 for the first time, after previously raising claims of ineffective assistance of appellant counsel, but not this claim. Appellant has the entire record here is appellant continuing to shift positions, not only from the statement to his affidavit, but in all of his pleadings. and then wants to go back and come on to some little snippet that he mentioned about exculpatory witnesses. As we show in our brief, the exculpatory witnesses were the police. He made it very clear in his pleading. It was the police officer and the investigator about the vehicles. He never mentioned alibi witnesses, and then try to recharacterize his earlier pleadings is insulting to this court, quite frankly. Unless there are further questions, I urge that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you. Mr. Axon has no time. Why don't you take a minute, Mr. Axon?
First, I would say that the government never cross-appealed that the district court found that Martinez v. Williams allowed Mr. Adams to go forward in the district court. So the question of timing, when the district court decided it, was not appealed by the government. It was not cross-appealed.
Why is there a need to cross-appeal?
Well, the government stood here and said that I waived it, that the appellant
waived. The basic position of the government is once they district court opinion affirmed, period. Full stop, right? There's no need to cross-appeal under those circumstances.
The district court opinion allowed Mr. Adams to go forward, finding that he had not been time-barred.
Yes, but the outcome was one which was entirely acceptable to the government.
Yes.
There's no need for cross-appeal.
I understand. But the question of timing is something that the government has raised, not appellant. So for the government to now say that the appellant waived it by not requesting that the question of timing be decided in the COA, that's what's counterintuitive. Timing was on our side when the COA was issued. So the appellant never would have had a need to raise timing. It's only the intervening decision that assists the government, Head v. Wilson, that allows the government. McQuiggan is also intervening after the district court made its decision. And I don't think that this court should ignore McQuiggan. The Supreme Court has made it clear that in habeas proceedings where there's a claim of innocence, courts certainly should not ignore those claims and should give them fulsome consideration. I'd just like to correct two factual matters, and the court can review these matters for itself in the record that's in the appendix. But Sterling Johnson does not identify Mr. Adams on the day that Hamilton is murdered. He identifies Mr. Adams on the day he is robbed and the day after. So he does not say that Mr. Adams is coming out of the woods. Someone who knows Mr. Adams, which they say is their strongest evidence that Mr. Adams committed these murders, is not the person that identifies him. Persons that identify Mr. Adams are the persons I identify in the brief. You have Mr. Wright and Mr. Mountjoy, who are in the woods at the same time.
All right, what's the second fact?
The government also claimed, and I actually find this offensive that they paint with such a broad brush, all of the people who were on the blacktop, the location of Mr. Adams' alibi, that all of those people are drug dealers and heroin dealers. That is not what Mr. Adams said. Mr. Adams said that he was dealing drugs. He did not impugn all of these other people. So there are 15 people that he identifies. Through the course of this litigation, there are 21 alibi witnesses. With each, I understand that defense attorney spoke to at least one, possibly two of these. But with each alibi witness, Mr. Adams' evidence becomes stronger and stronger. And Mr. Adams has never had an attorney investigate, the assistance of an attorney to investigate those alibi witnesses and to assess the strength of their testimony in light of the weak trial testimony against him, the weak evidence against him. I know that my time is up.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.